Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 360, The Ties That Bind, Part 4, being recorded on May 19th of 2002. In the past week, there have been a number of interesting disclosures ranging from considerable and heated discussion in the media about warnings that elements of U.S. intelligence had and briefings that they had given to the Bush administration about September 11th. And there have also been some perhaps even more disturbing indications that something very big may be in the offing, including perhaps a nuclear attack, some sort of nuclear terrorist incident in the Northeast or someplace else. We're going to be reprising some elements from past broadcasts and supplementing those. And one of the things to note is who actually is behind Al-Qaeda, what it appears to be, frankly, which is an extension of the underground Reich. This is, meaning the quote, war on terrorism, unquote, is, in my opinion, a direct extension of the Second World War. Reprising quickly a Nazi geopolitical concept, and that is the concept of the Earth Island. Look at a globe. Look at a map. Look at the landmass stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way on across Europe, the former Soviet Union, most of the Middle East, China, and India. That is one giant landmass. The Nazis call that the Earth Island. If you look across the center of the Earth Island, you will see a mass of Muslim population, and you will see that population overlapping most of the areas where the world's petroleum reserves exist. In the Nazi viewpoint, control the Earth Island, and by controlling the Muslim population of same, you will, and you control the world. In addition, the world's 1.2 billion Muslims are regarded by the Nazis as a very useful and altogether expendable commodity to wipe out not only the United States, but the Jews. And if the United States and the Jews should happen to wipe out the Muslims and the Arabs, so much the better in the Nazi viewpoint. This is both sides against the middle. So note who is helping to fund the horrors that have already taken place and the horrors that are about to take place. We're going to be taking a look at the ties that bind, reprising an article that we looked at in For the Record 359 from the Financial Times of Wednesday, May 8th of 2002, and consider this in connection with the latest warnings. Bin Laden supporters still funding Al-Qaeda, unquote, by Kathy Newman, a political correspondent. The Al-Qaeda terrorist network has been deluged with funds from Osama bin Laden's Saudi supporters, note that, since the start of the Middle East crisis, a British intelligence dossier has revealed. Intelligence chiefs have also warned the government that Mr. bin Laden could be plotting another terrorist atrocity on the scale of the September 11th attack on the World Trade Center. One senior minister said he was shocked by the scale of the threat outlined in the chilling intelligence briefing presented to the government recently. It suggested that the September 11th atrocities could be repeated at any time. Ministers are concerned that although the U.S. and the U.K. remain officially on high alert for further terrorist attacks, the public has become complacent about the risk. The minister said, quote, "Bin Laden might be cornered in a cave, but that won't necessarily prevent Al-Qaeda from carrying out further attacks. We were pretty shocked at what we heard." Quote, "The American attacks were 5 years in the planning. Who knows what could also be in the pipeline." Unquote. Despite the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan, the Al-Qaeda network has been regrouping. There have been a series of arrests and terrorist funds have been targeted around the world, but the network has been kept afloat by new money, note from Saudi Arabia, and a stream of fresh recruits. Sometimes you can make a long story short. In my discussion of the Underground Reich, the Bormann Organization, connections with the Bush family, the oil business, and Saudi Arabia, and Al-Qaeda, things I was warning about well before the 2000 election, just look at the recent conference that Crown Prince Abdullah had with Crown Prince George Walker bin Talal Abdul Aziz, the colonial magistrate for the Saudi states of America. And look at that picture of George with his arm around Crown Prince Abdullah. That is rather like the appeasement of Hitler at Munich. And we're going to be taking a look at the ties that bind, and one of the things that binds George Bush to the vast majority of Americans, and they are bound with, frankly, guilt and responsibility, and that is oil. And through oil, money. And we're going to be taking a look at some of the flows between Saudi Arabia, between powerful interests around the world, and in particular, we're going to take a look at financial transactions involving the Underground Reich. In addition to the ties that bind, this program might be subtitled Connecting the Dots, and I've forgotten how many of those I've done, but we're going to be illustrating the ties that bind, and we're going to be doing so by connecting the dots. One of the major areas of exploration of these broadcasts for many, many years has been the nexus surrounding the P2 Lodge, or Propaganda Due Lodge, in Italy, that headed up by former Mussolini fascist Licio Gelli, an honored guest at Ronald Reagan's inauguration. We have in turn taken a look at the profound overlap between the P2 milieu and the Vatican banking scandals. Two members of the P2, Roberto Calvi and Michele Sindona, both of whom died under strange circumstances, were advisors to the Vatican Bank. And there was a very, very suspicious series of transactions going through the Vatican Bank that in past discussion we have termed the Mediterranean merry-go-round. Note that the current president of Italy, the current head of Italy, Silvio Berlusconi, was a member of the P2. Note the strong connections between Prince Al-Walid of Saudi Arabia and Silvio Berlusconi, their mutual connections to Youssef Nada, the head of Al-Taqwa. Note that the Gulf Office subsidiary of Al-Taqwa was investigated in connection with Operation Clean Hands, which in turn investigated the P2 and Licio Gelli. I can appreciate that many of the things that I'm talking about will sound strange or incredible. Get the back programs from Spitfire. I'll tell you more about that later. And take advantage of the programs that are on air, and those are available. All of the For the Record programs are available from sister station WFMU. And in particular, take advantage of the small book that I have already put together about September 11th. Those are the program descriptions for the Record 325 and counting. They are up on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. They have been reformatted to make them easier to read and to use, and they already constitute a book about September 11th. Relatively short book, maybe 150 pages and counting, but it's a book nonetheless. Now, one of the major financial conduits that we have looked at in connection with the funding of Al-Qaeda, allegedly, and certainly with SECO, the Saudi investment company, the very powerful European branch of the massive bin Laden economic empire, we're going to take a look at In These Times magazine's issue of March 15th of 2002, and we're going to be taking a look at another excerpt of a very important article called Explosive Revelations, this by Lucy Komiser, spelled K-O-M-I-S-A-R, I'm not sure how that's pronounced. Now, the Clearstream Network is in turn an offshoot of Sedel, and it was 50% owned by Deutsche Börse, the German stock exchange. That was the Clearstream Network was bought out completely by Deutsche Börse in early 2002, after September 11th. One of the founders of the Clearstream Network is in turn Ernest Baquez, whom, as we have seen, has claimed that Clearstream was heavily involved with Osama bin Laden. He also has alleged that the September 11th financial conduits would ultimately go to a series of financial fronts set up by Nazi banker François Genoux, about whom we will say more later in the program. In These Times, March 15th of 2002, their web address will be annotated in the Spitfire description of For the Record 360. Lucy Komiser writes as follows. And bear in mind that her source here, Ernest Baquez, one of Europe's foremost experts about money laundering, helped to set up the Clearstream Network and then blew the whistle on it later when it became apparent that it was being used for corrupt purposes. Speaking of Clearstream and the Banco Ambrosiano and the Mediterranean merry-go-round, P2, etc., Sedel and its main competitor, Brussels-based Euroclear, were starting to manage transfers of, quote, euro dollars, unquote, U.S. currency kept in banks outside the United States. According to Barbara Garson's book, Money Makes the World Go Round, euro dollars were invented in the 1950s by the Chinese and the Soviets so they would not have to put their assets in banks where the U.S. government could seize them. But others saw value in euro dollars, and they began to be traded for other currencies. Some banks attracted euro dollars with higher interest than was being paid in America, and U.S. corporations and individuals began using the accounts to avoid laws on domestic banks. The euro money market was born. By the 1990s, the Federal Reserve estimated that about two-thirds of U.S. currency was held abroad as euro dollars, skipping down. By 1980, Ernest Backes had become Sedel's number three official in charge of relations with clients, but he was fired in May of 1983. Backes says the reason given for his sacking was an argument with an English banker, a friend of the CEO. Quote, "I think I was fired because I knew too much about the Ambrosiano scandal," Backes says. Banco Ambrosiano was once the second most important private bank in Italy, with the Vatican as a principal shareholder and loan recipient. The bank laundered drug and arms trafficking money for the Italian and American mafias, and in the 1980s channeled Vatican money to the Contras in Nicaragua and Solidarity in Poland. The corrupt managers also siphoned off funds via fictitious banks to personal shell company accounts in Switzerland, the Bahamas, Panama, and other offshore havens. Banco Ambrosiano collapsed in 1982 with a deficit of more than $1 billion. Unknown to many moviegoers, Banco Ambrosiano inspired a subplot of The Godfather, Part 3. Several of those behind the swindle have met untimely ends. Bank chairman Roberto Calvi was found hanged under Blackfriars Bridge in London. Michele Sindona, convicted in 1980 on 65 counts of fraud in the United States, was extradited to Italy in 1984 and sentenced to life in prison. In 1986, he was found dead in his cell, poisoned by cyanide-laced coffee. Another suspect, Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, the head of the Vatican Bank, now lives in Sun City, Arizona, with a Vatican passport. U.S. authorities have ignored a Milan arrest warrant for him. Just 2 months after Backes' dismissal in 1983, Soissons, 48, and healthy, was found dead in Corsica where he'd gone on vacation. Top Sedel officials had the body returned immediately and buried with no autopsy, announcing that he had died of a heart attack. His family now suspects he was murdered. If Soissons was murdered, it was also related to what he knew about Ambrosiano, Backes says. When Soissons died, the Ambrosiano affair wasn't yet known as a scandal. After it was revealed, I realized that Soissons and I had been at the crossroads. We moved all those transactions known later in the scandal to Lima and other branches. Nobody even knew there was a Banco Ambrosiano branch in Lima and other South American countries. After Sedel, Backes got a job in the Luxembourg stock market and later became a manager of a butcher's cooperative. But he kept friends inside the clearinghouse and began to collect information and records about Sedel's operations. With Soissons out of the way, there was nothing to stop the abuse of the system. Whereas Soissons had refused numerous requests to open non-published accounts from institutions such as Chase Manhattan in New York, Chemical Bank of London, and numerous subsidiaries of Citibank, Sedel opened hundreds of non-published accounts in total irregularity, especially after the arrival of CEO André Lucy in 1990. No longer were they just sub-accounts of officially listed accounts, Backes charges. Some were for banks that weren't subsidiaries or even official members of Sedel. At the start of 1995, Sedell had more than 2,200 published accounts, but in reality, according to documents obtained by Bacchus, Sedell that year managed more than 4,200 accounts for more than 2,000 clients from 73 countries. And more about the background of Sedell and Clearstream. Clearstream, and again, a major funding conduit according to Bacchus for September 11th, Clearstream also strongly connected to SECO, the Saudi investment company, European branch of the powerful bin Laden economic and financial empire. Clearstream was formed in 1999 out of the merger of Sedell and the compensation company of Deutsche Börse, the German stock exchange. No accounts are secret, insists spokesman Graham Cope. We are controlled by the local authorities who have access to information on all accounts. The term secret is misused again and again. Our customers choose to have unpublished accounts, which simply means, like a telephone number, they choose not to display the name and number in our publications. Customers often have unpublished accounts, which they use for their own internal management purposes to ensure there is no confusion between their accounts, unquote. But Bacchus thinks otherwise. I discovered an increasing number of unpublished accounts, he says. There were more unpublished than published accounts, and a large proportion were not sub-accounts of a principal account, which is what the system was supposedly for. The owners of these accounts were not inscribed on the official clients of the firm, unquote. And, by the way, the Soissons alluded to there was Gerhard Soissons, along with Bacchus, one of the founders of the Clearstream Network. Now, again, by taking a look at some of the ties that bind, and by the way, for details about the death of Roberto Calvi, who was found hanged under Blackfriars Bridge in London, for details about the death of Michele Sindona, RFA programs 17 through 21, dealing with the events in and around the shooting of Pope John Paul II in May of 81, and the death of his predecessor a couple of years earlier. That is all discussed at considerable length in RFAs 17 through 21. Those are available from Spitfire. Still more about that affair, and this from a website, Bulletin, deepblacklies.co.uk. This is by a fellow named David Guyatt. It's called Revelations. It is a part of a review of a book called Revelations by Ernest Bacchus and Denise Robert. Some years following the opening of the first two accounts, Roberto Calvi was later found hanged beneath London's Blackfriars Bridge. And that, again, alludes to Roberto Calvi. I would note that Mr. Guyatt had considerable experience with Clearstream. He had met Gerhard Soissons along with Ernest Bacchus while working for the Wall Street investment firm Blythe Eastman Dillon. Now, more about the Clearstream Network, and we're going to take a look at allegations also by Lucy Komeiser in a sidebar to the In These Times article I just read. And this deals with the alleged role of the Clearstream Network in the October Surprise, as it has come to be known, the deal between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran to withhold the U.S. hostages who had been taken prisoner until after Jimmy Carter's election defeat, or his humiliation and consequent election defeat, were assured. Bear in mind in this connection the allegation that was carried in an article in the San Francisco Chronicle of March 12th of 2002 that it was Nazi banker François Janoux who paid for the Ayatollah Khomeini's exile in France. Bear in mind also that François Janoux was heavily involved with the Arab financial branches in Algeria. That was much of his start. That constituted much of his start as a banker with various Middle Eastern nationalist movements. And note where some of these October Surprise monies came from. This is from October Surprises, a sidebar to the In These Times article from March 15th, also by Lucy Komeiser. It reads, in November of 1979, the U.S. Embassy in Iran was seized and 52 Americans were held hostage. Their capture and the Carter administration's failure to win their release became a major issue in the 1980 presidential campaign. Carter had frozen billions in Iranian assets in U.S. banks, money that was being claimed by American firms and individuals who had lost property in the Islamic Revolution. American and Iranian officials were negotiating the amount of funds to be released in return for freeing the hostages. The Iranians also wanted Carter to release arms that had been ordered and paid for by the deposed Shah. Reagan campaign officials allegedly met with Iranian representatives several times during the 1980 campaign, promising arms and money if Iran delayed release of the hostages until after the November election. This scandal would become known as the October Surprise, unquote. Reagan won the election, but Carter officials continued to negotiate with the Iranians. Finally, around the turn of the year, an accord was reached under which the United States would release $4 billion but no arms. However, the Iranians did not release the hostages immediately. A few days before Reagan's inauguration, Ernest Baca's recalls, Sedell got an urgent joint instruction from the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank and the Bank of England to transfer $7 million in bearer bonds, $5 million from an account of Chase Manhattan Bank, and $2 million from an account of Citibank, both in offshore secrecy havens. The money was to go to the National Bank of Algeria and from there to an Iranian bank in Tehran. Baca's was informed that the $7 million was a small fraction of sums being sent from around the world and concentrated in the Algerian bank. He was told the transfers were linked to the fate of the hostages. The Fed and the Bank of England were not members of Sedell and by its rules had no right to order the transfers. Baca's two superiors were absent. He informed the president of the Sedell Administrative Council, Edmund Israel, then acted to execute the order. Israel, now honorary chairman, did not respond to phone and email messages. On January 20, 1981, about 15 minutes after Reagan took the oath of office, the hostages were finally freed. Reagan and then Vice President George Bush have always denied the payoff. And this, again, dealing with the October Surprise. We're going to review an element that we looked at in, for the record, program number 354, and this concerns Salem bin Laden, who in turn was represented by James R. Bath, and who was very closely connected through James R. Bath to George W. Bush. He also may have been involved with some of the October Surprise negotiations. Reviewing now from the book, In the Name of Osama bin Laden, subtitled Global Terrorism and the Bin Laden Brotherhood, published by Ronan Jacquard, published in softcover by the Duke University Press, this from the paperback edition, ISBN number 0-8223-2991-3. Of Salem bin Laden and his alleged involvement in the October Surprise, bin Laden's son, Salem bin Laden, was also very close to the Saudi king, and it is likely that he rendered significant services to the monarchy, in particular by carrying out secret missions. According to several witnesses, his mysterious death is evidence of this. In 1988, a BAC-111 plane piloted by Salem crashed in Texas. His death gave rise to speculations about the exact role he played for King Fahd and the Saudi government in secret operations in the Middle East and Central America. For instance, there was an indication from American sources that he was connected to a secret meeting between Iranian and American emissaries in Paris in October of 1980. Some felt that his death was not an accident. By the way, he may also have been killed in the crash of a light plane, not a BAC-111. But his death is very interesting in light of the connections. Now, as a branch to a next major element of discussion, we're going to be talking about SECO, the Saudi investment company, which apparently had a number of different Clearstream accounts, according to Ernest Baca's. Bear in mind that the co-chairman of the board of SECO is a Swiss citizen named Baudin Dunant, who in turn was a lawyer for François Genoux, an individual whose name has cropped up in connection with the September 11th investigation in a number of different contexts, ranging from Genoux's connections to Zacharias Moussaoui, the 20th hijacker's French attorney, who is Isabelle Coutant-Père, the future wife of Carlos the Jackal. Genoux was alleged in the March 12th Chronicle article to have been the founder of Al-Taqwa. Ernest Backes has alleged that the financial conduits for September 11th, now apparently being replumbed from Saudi sources in anticipation of another attack on the United States. Ernest Backes has claimed that François Genoux was heavily involved with the setting up of those financial institutions. Turning once again to the book in the name of Osama bin Laden of Geneva SICO, the Saudi investment company, it is headed by Islam bin Laden, and the board of directors is made up almost exclusively of members of the family clan, except for a Swiss citizen, Baudin Dunant. This well-known lawyer from French-speaking Switzerland, who was on the boards of several dozen companies, came to public notice in 1983 when he agreed to represent the Swiss banker François Genoux, a controversial figure who had been a disciple of Hitler and sole heir of Goebbels' copyrights before becoming one of the financiers of the FLN during the Algerian War. The friendships of the bin Laden seem sometimes surprising, but they are logical. François Genoux has always been pro-Arab. More about Genoux inside two of this program. I've alluded to other broadcasts and made many, many references to names, perhaps obscure for members of the listening audience, websites, addresses, things to check out in order to clarify those terms and individuals. First of all of the broadcasts that I have done are available from a tape duplication service and CD duplication service called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, one word. Write to them at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, California 95005. Email them at mail, M-A-I-L, at SpitfireList, one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-A-L-I-S-T, .com. Visit their real audio equipped website at www.spitfirelist.com. In the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there are detailed annotated descriptions of the programs that are available and all of the programs that have been done on September 11th. For the Record 325 and counting are available in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. They are reformatted, and this in answer to many people's inquiries. They ask me, when are you going to publish? I have. When are you going to write a book? I am. It's there, and it's growing all the time. All you bloody well have to do is to print it up and read it. And there are links in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. That station is right across the river from Ground Zero, WFMU.org/Dave Emery, DaveEmory. Have more recent broadcast streaming. There is also another website with older broadcasts available for download only. Once again, the Spitfire website is equipped with real audio, and the two most recent programs are available there. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 360, The Ties That Bind, Part 4, being recorded on May 19th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.